Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program discussing issues of concern to the family and those who hold traditional family values in Pennsylvania and our nation. Archives of these programs can be heard at www.afafpa.org. And now, your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
President Trump continues working to fulfill his campaign promises of making the U.S. more energy independent and creating jobs through the process. On March 28th, he issued a six-page executive order to address the multiple attacks on America's energy sector during the 8 years under Obama. As EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt noted, under this new executive order, the EPA would no longer be picking winners and losers. My guest today is Dr. Calvin Beister. He's the founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Thanks, Dr. Beister, for being with us.
Well, thank you, Diane. Glad to be back with you.
You're looking at President Trump's first 2 months, a little over 2 months in office, as he has issued or addressed energy independence issue for the U.S. What kind of, do you think he's fulfilling his campaign promises on a timely basis? I guess that'd be the best way to put that.
Well, I think he's doing pretty well. I think I'd come to give him perhaps a B-plus or an A-minus on that. One of his campaign promises was that he was going to pull us out of the Paris Climate Agreement. He hasn't done that, although the executive order that he issued on energy independence day before yesterday, on Tuesday, makes it, for all practical purposes, extremely unlikely that the United States will fulfill the intentions that the Obama administration announced in embracing the Paris Agreement, but I would have liked to have seen him go ahead and formally announce that we are no longer a party, and or indeed that we never were a party to the Paris Agreement, since in fact, though Obama preferred to call it merely an agreement or an executive agreement, it has all the legal hallmarks of a treaty, and it should have been submitted to the Senate for ratification. But, of course, Obama didn't do that because he knew it would have failed.
Right. And he tended to have a habit of doing things like that, working around the Senate when it came to...
If Congress won't act, I will.
Right, exactly. And renaming things from a treaty to an agreement or whatever. And
right.
So at least the executive order did address, to a point, the Paris Accord. So that's encouraging. And so we hope that he will go forward and formally withdraw us from that. Just as a quick review, what are some of the things that are included in the Paris Agreement?
Well, the Paris Agreement was signed by roughly 195 countries from around the world, each of them announcing its intentions. There is, by the way, no legally binding aspect to the Paris Agreement on any country involved. But the various countries announced their intentions about restricting emissions of carbon dioxide beginning in the year 2030. That, you know, set it off by, at the time that the agreement was agreed in Paris in December of 2015, set it off by 15 years. None of those was legally enforceable, and for the large developing countries like China and India, their intentions actually didn't differ significantly from business as usual. They made it very clear, both India and China, that they intended to continue to expand their use of fossil fuels to provide the electricity that is absolutely indispensable to lifting their people out of poverty, mm-hmm. which they said was their number one priority, and I think quite rightly so, because poverty is far more dangerous to human health and longevity than is anything related to climate change. But the agreement involved all of these declarations of intention about supposed reduction overall of CO2 emissions. Well, if in fact you accept the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates on the warming effect of CO2, the entire difference that full implementation would make of all of those intentions from now to the end of this century in global average temperature would be 0.3 degrees Celsius.
Three tenths, not even a full degree.
Right, 0.3 of one. Actually, 0.306. So it's 306 ten-thousandths of 1 degree Celsius, which would have no impact on any ecosystem, and certainly not on human well-being. But again, accepting all of the claims of the UN IPCC the cost of achieving that would be somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion per year from 2030 to 2100. That means 70 to $140 trillion to reduce global average temperature by 0.3 of a degree in 2100. That, I think, is just absurdly expensive.
I thought trees needed things like CO2.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The alarmists on this only look at the warming effect of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is real, but probably anywhere from half to one-fourth of what they think it is. But they don't look at the benefits either of the warming or of the CO2 fertilization of plants.
Yeah.
All plants need CO2 to grow. Yeah. And as they get more of it, they grow more. They have they increase their fruit to fiber ratio. They grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures, and in wetter and drier soils. And they make better use of soil nutrients. And their crop yields rise, which means that food for everything that eats plants, or that eats something that eats plants, becomes more plentiful.
Yeah.
And
wow.
The poor around the world benefit more than anybody else.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah, they just look at one aspect of this, and it's just crazy. It was encouraging back, I think it was on March 9th, that the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said that he did not believe carbon dioxide is a primary contributor to global warming. So that's
right.
Encouraging, but not surprising from Scott Pruitt. But that was encouraging that we have someone like him in as the EPA Administrator now. So let's look at this executive order. And what were some of the components of that President Trump dealt with? I know he dealt with some of it was he lifts a short-term ban on new leases for coal mining on public lands.
Yeah, it does that. It lifts that ban on new leases for coal mining. It also effectively blocks fulfillment of U.S. intentions under the Paris Climate Agreement, and it requires recalculation of the so-called social cost of carbon. And this recalculation would probably result in making the so-called social cost of carbon so low that it would be difficult to justify any regulations mm-hmm. restricting carbon dioxide emissions on a cost-benefit basis. Quickly say why I'm calling that the so-called social cost of carbon.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually a very deceptive phrase for two reasons. First of all, in terms of the word carbon. No, it's not carbon. It's carbon dioxide. And, you know, Diane, you and I, back when we were in elementary school, we studied the table of the elements, remember?
Right. Oh, yeah.
And we knew the difference between an element, which was one particular kind of thing, say hydrogen or oxygen or uranium or, in this case, carbon, right?
Right,
and
right.
a compound, which is two elements or more linked together. Carbon dioxide is a compound, not an element, and the distinction is not just academic. It's very important. Carbon by itself is normally solid in form. In the form of fine dust particles, it can cause upper respiratory diseases when you inhale it.
Okay.
That's kind of dangerous.
Right.
Carbon
mm-hmm.
dioxide, in contrast, is not a solid. It's a gas.
And I remember that part.
Yeah. And it is.
It's what we breathe out.
Colorless.
Isn't that what we
odorless.
Breathe out? We breathe.
Yeah. It's colorless, odorless, non-toxic. You and I breathe out carbon dioxide at about 40,000 parts per million time we exhale.
Every time.
Yeah. whereas the average concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now is about 404 parts per million. In other words. about one-hundredth of the atmospheric concentration. Carbon dioxide doesn't become toxic to us until it reaches about 10,000 parts per million, and we have to keep breathing that in for not hours, but days or even months in a row. So it's basically non-toxic. They're saying social cost of carbon mixes carbon with carbon dioxide, or confuses the two, rather, which is very deceptive. But second, when they calculate this, they assume that the warming effect of added CO2 in the atmosphere is very high, whereas the best empirical evidence indicates that it's very low. And then they assume that we're going to get far more harm than good from that warming, whereas, again, the best empirical evidence indicates that we'll probably get more good than harm.
Mm-hmm.
And they completely ignore the benefit of that added carbon dioxide for plant growth and crop yield, meaning for food supply. So the so-called social cost of carbon is very deceptive, and I think Trump has quite rightly required its recalculation.
So previously, I can't remember what the previous EPA director's name was, but it was a woman, though. Yeah, it was a woman.
Yes.
Who did she consult? I mean, where did these scientists go to school at? Where did they learn their chemistry? I mean, obviously they are well-schooled in deceptive language, but not in chemistry, not in science.
Well, the scientists behind this all, of course, know that. It's the politicians who adopt this kind of very deceptive language. They know it's a rhetorical battle as much as it is a scientific battle. And so, you know, we really should not blame the scientists, no matter what their position on global warming is. We should blame the politicians who really confuse things.
Who confuse things, and it's becoming more of a consistent problem with politicians. But yet they do say, and one of the things that the politicians say, well, there's all these scientists out there who know that global warming is happening.
Well, hey, you know what? I know that global warming is happening. And I know hundreds of so-called climate change skeptics.
Right?
Uh-huh. I don't know any of them who deny that climate change is happening. The issue is not whether climate changes.
Uh-huh.
Everybody agrees. The issue is not whether human activity, including the emission of carbon dioxide, contributes to climate change. I only know a tiny handful mm-hmm. who would question that,
mm-hmm.
and they don't really even question it very heartily.
Right.
The issue is whether the warming that comes from human emissions of CO2 is going to have a potentially catastrophic effect,
mm-hmm.
which is believed by the climate alarmists,
mm-hmm.
or will have a very small effect and perhaps a more beneficial than harmful effect, which is believed by many of the so-called climate skeptics. And so that's where the real debate is. And frankly, the empirical evidence increasingly supports the view that our adding CO2 to the atmosphere will cause minimal warming, probably more benefit than harm from it, and certainly great benefit in terms of plant growth from the CO2's direct fertilization effect of the plant.
Right. And we have to have the plant growth because, I mean, because vegetables, I mean, that's a plant, and all those kind of things that we eat. Let alone the animals that, you know, that eat other plants and we eat the animals, and it's just all a cycle.
Right.
So
all life depends on CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just
And
trouble.
In terms of geologic history, even at 400 parts per million, roughly what we have now, we are at the lower end of where CO2 has been. In past eons, CO2 has been much higher as a percentage of the atmosphere, and plant growth was much more lush during those periods. We would do well to see CO2 rise to 600, 800, 1,200 parts per million, but actually some calculations indicate that even if we burned all the fossil fuels in the crust of the Earth, we couldn't drive CO2 concentration above perhaps 1,000 parts per million because so much CO2 has already been sequestered in limestones and other forms of rock.
So maybe God had a design in all this?
You just almost
just maybe,
think so.
For sure. Wow.
But of course, you know, the atheists cannot admit that kind of thinking.
That's
just
true.
In correspondence today on an article where comments were coming in where one person ridiculed any reference to God in such things. Well, you know, I guess his atheistic presupposition is free from critique, whereas somebody's theistic presupposition is only to be ridiculed. That, of course, is mere prejudice, not reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we see more and more in this increasingly secular postmodern world. One of the portions of the executive order eliminates all requirement that all federal agencies include climate change effects in calculating costs and benefits of future environmental permits. I don't think people realize to the extent that the Obama administration had their hands in, I mean, so many aspects when it came to what they considered catastrophic climate change, to where even federal agencies had to take into effect climate change effects when they're calculating cost and such.
Yeah, that is so, and that resulted, for one thing, in employing an awful lot of people in doing the calculations necessary and gathering the information and doing the calculations. It was a good job maker for bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
But it also made all the permitting processes much more expensive, and it made it more difficult to get permits to do construction, to do mining, to do oil extraction, natural gas extraction, and so on. All of these different things all became far more expensive. So basically, it slowed economic growth and thus kept Americans from becoming more prosperous.
Yeah.
The executive order that Trump issued has eliminated that requirement. And as a result, all of this will become much less expensive, and we'll see a freeing up of economic growth, economic development.
Well, that's good, because that's definitely something that this country needs. And in this area, northwestern Pennsylvania, mining is a major thing. And the mining industry has been so hurt by the Obama administration the last 8 years. Do you think it can rebound?
Well, it will. I assume you're speaking basically of the coal mining
industry.
Right,
right. Yeah,
and,
true.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, Obama waged an 8-year-long war on coal,
mm-hmm.
and the environmentalists want that to continue. The coal industry will rebound somewhat by the removal of the restrictions that the Obama administration placed upon it. But I don't think that we should expect that it will rise to where it was even as much as 8 or 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
let alone where it was 30, 40, 50, 100
sure.
years
right.
ago. And there are two reasons for that. One is that so much more of the work of extracting coal from the earth has been automated. And that's actually a good thing, because it frees people up to do other productive
exactly.
things
mm-hmm.
that machines can't do, right?
Right.
But the other reason is that the cost of extracting natural gas from the earth and using that to generate electricity instead of coal has plummeted because of the rise of fracking and horizontal
mm-hmm.
drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that it's simply cheaper for a lot of electric generating plants in the United States, anyway, to use natural gas than to use coal. But President Trump's executive order here removes all the artificial barriers to the coal industry, and we will see some recovery of employment in that industry here in America. But it also will make it much easier for developing countries to ignore the pressure of environmentalists to not use the vast coal resources that they have that are very important to providing the electricity necessary to lift their populations out of poverty. So that's a very good thing.
Yeah,
we
absolutely.
We should see considerable growth overseas.
Do you think, and I don't know if you can answer this, but do you think that when President Trump officially pulls us out of the Paris Agreement, do you think that will make the whole thing crumble?
Yeah, the Europeans will probably try to keep it going, but certainly a lot of developing nations will say, well, with the U.S. out,
mm-hmm.
we're getting out too. And besides that, the actual intentions expressed by most of the developing nations didn't make any significant difference between what their CO2 emissions would be without
okay.
the Paris Agreement and what they would be with it.
Okay.
So I think it will crumble,
okay.
and that's a good thing.
Yeah,
it'll
absolutely.
Free people up.
Yeah, and so basically the U.S. would have been carrying the bulk of the making the changes, because we're the big bad. This is the way the environmentalists view the U.S., is that we're the big bad boogeyman, and we're out to destroy the earth. I mean, that's kind of the
yeah.
way the radical environmentalists especially, I think, view the U.S., because we are a highly industrial nation, and some of these radical environmentalists, I believe, blame the industrial, industries in creating the situations, what they view as negative situations or consequences of the climate.
What they should also do, Diane, is to simply compare the cleanness of air and water and soil in the United States with the dirtiness of air and soil and water in most developing countries.
Yeah.
Poverty is the biggest threat to the environment, because a clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. Richer people afford more costly goods than poorer people do. I mean, that's a very simple thing.
Yeah.
And as societies grow out of subsistence agriculture into early industry, yes, they get more pollution, but the benefits of that industry actually outweigh the risks of the pollution, which is why human health and life expectancy rise even at the same time that pollution rises. But once they reach certain levels, the people can then afford the expensive technologies necessary to clean up their industry,
and then
pollution emissions decline,
and
before long, they actually have a cleaner world than they had before they began to industrialize. That's the history of the United States and every other advanced industrialized nation, and that will be the history of the developing nations if they're allowed to develop.
Yeah,
but unfortunately,
yeah,
too many environmentalists don't want them to.
Yeah, that's tragic. Well, do you think this executive order will be challenged in the courts?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, the left-wing environmentalists have announced that. They say they're going to fight it in the Congress. They're going to fight it in the states. They're going to fight it in the courts. They're going to fight it in the streets. I mean, they're borrowing, of course, the kind of language that Churchill used in
Stonebridge
speech.
Right, exactly. And of course, they'll go judge shopping and pick a friendly judge. Just as they've done with the immigration issue. So
the battles are not over by a long shot, which is why it's so important that the critics of this kind of thing continue our work, such as us at the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation.
Right. And how can folks contact you guys?
Come to cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org on the web. We have hundreds of articles and lots of major papers that we've published on this and related issues. They can sign up for our free electronic newsletter there. They can also read our posts on Facebook, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And we have a particular blog specially designed for millennials and younger people called Earth Rising Blog.
EarthRisingBlog.com. Along the question of the millennials, do you think they're getting it, or have they bought into, because they're so indoctrinated in schools, high school and college, about the dangers of climate change?
Yeah, it is a difficult thing because so much of the public school system has been harnessed to the environmental extremist position. That is affected partly by the fact that the so-called next generation science standards, which we got piggybacked in with the Common Core in so many states' curricula, has made climate change a part of the curriculum from kindergarten right straight through 12th grade.
Mm.
So it's a difficult thing. But, you know, millennials are smart people. They tend to question authority a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you question, the more you find out the weakness of the case for dangerous man-made global warming.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, over the long haul, they'll come around.
It's
a difficult battle for all ages, and we all just need to be learning. We need to do what the Apostle Paul told us in 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Test all things, hold fast what is good.
Yep, absolutely. So cornwallalliance.org and earthrisingblog.com, was that?
Right.
Okay, earthrisingblog.com, geared towards millennials. Thanks so much, Dr. Beisner, for being with us. I really appreciate it. And
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate you guys
keeping me up to date on this stuff.
Okay, thanks very much, and God bless.
God bless you too. Take care.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in the efforts to defend traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA by writing to Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, Pennsylvania, 16323. Or by visiting their website at www.afafpa.org.